Hello, and welcome to another enchanting episode of My Dog Will Eat My Face. I've got to apologize right away. My voice is somewhat, what do I call it? Reluctant to not sound like a retired Reno hooker and chain smoker, but I assure you I'm neither of those. In other words, for some reason my voice is a little crackly and hoarse. So, is that a word? Hoarse? No, I guess it's horse. I don't know why I had a D on there. Anyway, I apologize for me sounding like a Reno hooker. But moving right along, and this podcast, I wanted to touch base on something that I have not actually fully talked about for quite some time now. In this podcast, I am going to address, from a somewhat 30,000-foot level, broadly speaking, what it is like to be dying. And I had a similar topic in the first year, I think, or the first few months when I was in hospice care, which has now been amazingly 3 to 4 years ago or so. It just blows my mind I've been in hospice that long. So, within all that time, I definitely have a lot more data to go on, so to speak. And so I think it's a good idea to reapproach that topic and share truly, probably much more accurately, what it is like, at least for me, to go through this process. So I know it's not necessarily a cheery topic, but it's something I feel that should be readdressed now that I obviously have so much more data, so to speak, to discuss this topic. And by that very nature, I think to address it now would be far more valuable than my initial assessment. And I intend to split this review, if you wish to call it that, into probably 2 episodes. So this is going to be the first one of 2. And in it, I wish to address the physical aspect of what it's like to be at, I guess, death's door. I'm going to talk about abilities that have waned or disappeared entirely, perhaps some that are not changed at all, and really just talk about as best I can those physical things. And then in a subsequent part 2 episode, I plan to address the ooey-gooey stuff that is the emotional aspect of what it's like for me. And I think addressing both will paint a clear picture of what I'm truly going through as I go through this process. So, that's my plan. Who knows if I deviate from that, if I change my mind. For all I know, I'm going to diverge and talk about pickles for an hour. I have no idea, because I usually don't script these out, but that's my plan. And, excuse me, hopefully I stick to it. It might not be very long. That's why I'm cutting this into two parts, to give my voice box a break. Any prolonged talking of any kind these days seems to really stress my voice quite a bit. So I shall truly do my best. And I think splitting it at least into two different episodes for those two topics will hopefully permit one, from the episode being excessively long, and two, allow me to still be able to speak to some extent at the end of the podcast. So again, this episode, I'm really going to try to focus on the physical aspects. And we all know the physical and the mental and the emotional, those are really hard to segregate lots of the time. They are all connected. So this plan may not work at all for all I know. Because it's really difficult to focus on just the physical things or just the emotional things sans the other physical aspects, or vice versa. They're so intertwined with one another, and they're so connected. I'll probably deviate a little bit here and there, but at least that's my goal in terms of breaking up this into two separate topics. And hang on to your butts, because here we go. So, as we dig into the physical aspects of what it's like to be dying, keep in mind, I am going to just discuss my own personal experience. And I'm absolutely certain I cannot speak for, frankly, not a single other human being for when they go through that process. There are so many ways to die. There are so many ways that you could be just taken instantly out of the living world. Gosh, this is really depressing. My point is, my experience is my own. I'm not speaking for anybody else. But maybe in stepping back and revisiting it, it might give me some clarity as to where I've been and where I'm going and what that might mean for me. And maybe that might also in some ways apply to someone you know or yourself. I don't know. But there's just so many ways for this action to happen. I don't think you can draw a similar line from any two people that are going through the death process. So first off, let me remind you what's causing this in the first place. I was born back in 1978. And I was constantly turning blue, and the doctors didn't really know why. I was clearly struggling to breathe, and they weren't sure what the problem was. But at closer to the age of one, they elected to do an open heart surgery, not really knowing what they were going to see when they got in there. Remember, this predates things like MRI scans and PET scans. And obviously they had x-rays. I think they had x-rays back then, but it's not like today. So the surgery was as much, if not more so, exploratory as it was an intervention into what is causing my distress. When, lo and behold, they cut me open and they find out right away I was born without a right pulmonary artery. Minor detail. And if you see one lying around somewhere, like in a King Supers parking lot or something, let me know, because that could be mine. You know, so just, you know, stay in touch with me. If you see it on a highway somewhere, please just, you know, just send me a quick message and I might be able to get out there and retrieve it. But anyway, they didn't have any means to graft a blood vessel because I was so young. There were no other suitable blood vessels that could replace the pulmonary artery. So they kind of weaned it, and using a Kevlar-like material, they created an artificial shunt to replace that pulmonary artery. And it was 100% artificial. There was no use of other arteries in the legs or grafting, because that was not an option, as I said. And in fact, that was the first time an entirely artificial portion of the body was developed in the lab and implanted to improve the function of the heart. And so that's kind of cool. They did write a lot of papers on it back then in the 70s. I was actually the first human being on this earth to ever receive an entirely artificial implant to the heart. So they wrote a lot of papers on it, and it was a pretty big deal back then. You know, this really opened the way to artificial valves and other implants and cardiac surgeries that will later save millions of lives. You know, so it was a real real breakthrough, I must say. And well, I grew up with that my whole life. I should have been following up with the cardiologist that whole time. I probably should have gotten that shunt enlarged at least several times. Because keep in mind, it's built for a one-year-old. I'm sure there's a little bit of slack. So like 2 and 3 years old, maybe it wouldn't be a big deal. But nonetheless, it was obviously a small size. And I never got it replaced. I hated going to the cardiologist because it was just doom and gloom. And I ignored it. And then it got a little bit worse later on, a little bit worse, and then a little bit worse. Until it really reached a breaking point. And I'll tell you really quick what that moment was. I can actually point to a singular moment in which everything for me in my life changed. At the time, I was working from home because it was a Friday before a 3-day weekend, so why not? But I was working from home, had my dog with me. I ordered lunch. I remember I got pho for lunch. And it was really like any other day. Well, certainly up to that point, I couldn't walk fast. I would run out of breath. I had difficulty carrying heavy things. I couldn't do athletics. Yeah, all those existed in varying degrees, but I was still able to work and hold down a job and drive my car and go out to eat. You know, basic things for me were still doable. I just couldn't go for a hike anymore, but that was a pretty mild thing to sacrifice for me. So it really didn't even register for me. Anyway, so this one day, I'm working from home, and I suddenly feel like I am short of breath. Massively short of breath. I had, at that time, an oxygen concentrator in the closet that I only used to put on a slow liter flow of oxygen at night. So during the day, I didn't use it. But since at this moment, I was feeling really distressed and short of breath, I cranked up that oxygen concentrator and slapped it on my face to get some oxygen in me. And I took my pulse ox, and what I saw was very, very strange. My oxygen level was fine. My pulse was pretty high. But there was no sign whatsoever connecting low oxygen levels to feeling short of breath. And as I sat there on the machine, I still felt short of breath. And when I took my pulse ox, it showed that I was not low on oxygen. So it was very weird. Then, a little while after that, this is now 3 p.m. on the Friday, you know, I am suddenly overwhelmed with a feeling of dread. I just somehow knew inside me that there was something seriously wrong. So, I called my ex to come pick up my dog, to take care of my dog. And then I called 911. And while I was on the phone with a 911 operator, I noticed that the chair I was sitting in was just all wet. And I thought to myself, oh, that dumb dog, he peed on this? Oh, great. You know, I was mad at the doggy. Peed on the chair, and I'm sitting in it, great. But then I look closer and notice, wait a minute, my jeans are wet in the front. The dog didn't pee the chair, I peed the chair. And I had no sensation whatsoever. I didn't feel like I had to urinate. I did not feel it coming out. I felt nothing whatsoever. Except the wetness that I was now sitting in and festering in. So even though I was still waiting on paramedics, I decided to quickly change my underwear and pants before they got there. Because I still had some sense of pride, so I did that. Paramedics arrive, and as they are hooking me up to the stretcher and all that, I suddenly just feel like I'm about to lose everything and throw it up. So I start pointing vigorously to a Tupperware item in my kitchen that was right there. And the paramedic knew, and he handed it to me, and I just threw up everything I'd ever eaten right there into the Tupperware. And essentially, everything was being evacuated from both sides of my body. And that is one of the stages of the body dying. People urinate and defecate on themselves and throw up whatever else. The body expunges itself of anything that's there. So that was pretty scary. Long story short, I'm in the hospital recovering. I still have not been told what went wrong, but I was feeling better. No thanks to anything they did. It just slowly got better over the few days after that. When I was in my room one moment, I was sitting there and my nurse was in there. When my cardiologist walked in, and I wasn't expecting him at all, and I saw him, and I said, oh, hey, I lit up, you know, it's a friendly face to me. I knew this guy. He walked in, I didn't even know he was gonna come and see me, so I was happy to see him. Otherwise, I was all by myself, no visitors. All my close family lives out of state at this point in my life, so I was all by myself. And when he came in, he asked the nurse to leave so we could have some privacy. And that was my first red flag that, oh no, there is something wrong. And she left, and he looked at me, and he said, "We finally know what was going on." And I basically said, "Give it to me." And what he said was, "Well, your right ventricle completely failed." And you on your own somehow recovered, but normally that's a pretty typical fatal event. And what it tells me, this is my cardiologist again speaking here, what that tells me is that we are now beyond the point of no return. And there is nothing we can do for you. I asked him, what does that mean for me? I mean, do I need to come in more often? Do I need to do something different with my regimen or my medications? He said, "No. I think you're going to have up to 3 years to live." So I then very quietly asked, "So should I be making my final arrangements?" And he nodded and said yes. Eventually, he left the room, and I sat there all by myself, no family, no friends, holding this news in my head, not knowing what to do. And that was the moment when I feel like I crossed over to basically another world. It wasn't long after that, in fact, that I was assigned to hospice. And I did not know this at the time, but just through a passing conversation with my sister-in-law the other day, she told me that hospice spoke to her and the rest of the family and said, "They think I will be gone in 2 weeks and that they are already seeing signs of a transition to death." So that's what kind of kicked me over to this new way of living, if you wish to call it anything. And that is a perfect example of the difficulty in separating the physical from the emotional. You can't tell that story, even though it's based purely on physical events in the human body. It is not a trigger and a major component to your emotional well-being, obviously. So that right away shows how it's difficult to separate the two. But again, I'll try. But I wanted to start there just as a recap. That's what led me to where I am today. And in point of fact, That was now about 4 years ago. I'm laughing because obviously 3 years, not quite, because I'm already up to year four. So I don't really know what's happening next. And then hospice's 2 week estimate was way out there. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But that is my introduction to the death process and more or less the world of hospice. So, my journey since then is, I would describe as a series of setbacks, obviously, and heavy swings to improvement, actually. So a lot of strong swings up and down, and of course I'm here speaking respective to my physical abilities. And if you were to plot it out, say, as a line graph over the course of the last 4 years, yes, you would have a lot of ups and downs. But if you were to follow the first high point, let's say, put a dot there, put a point there, and then connect it to the highest high point on the most recent data, you would show a steady decline over the years overall. So even though some days still are much better than others, overall, it's a slow and steady decline. I was trying to think of a fancier word, but my mental thesaurus failed me in that moment. Anyway, so that's what it's kind of like. And I've talked about that at great length with multiple nurses and doctors in hospice. And their reasoning with respect to that is the fact that I am so young. I'm, as of today, 45 years old. And I'm not, obviously, 90 years old, like a lot of people are who deal with this. And, oh my God, I forgot to say, that was my initial diagnosis with congestive heart failure. Sorry, I left that little minor detail out. God, I'm such a buffoon. Anyway, so, yes. So most people who get congestive heart failure are in their 80s or 90s, and it they don't last long, to be perfectly blunt. But as far as they see it, I'm 45. Yes, I have congestive heart failure and very severe pulmonary hypertension. But I'm relatively very young and in otherwise very good health. And that's why it is this prolonged, gradual sort of march to the sea for me, where it's a decline overall. But there are days that are definitely better than others in the meantime. So that's a little difficult to adapt to, but overall it's declining. My abilities are declining. Some are long gone or heavily a challenge or now challenged while I'm in hospice. For example, I can't fly on a plane. Because of how they pressurize the aircraft. Usually, commercial airliners are actually pressurized for 10,000 feet. And that altitude for me would be fatal, is what my doctors have said repetitively. Of course, they've been wrong about when I was going to die, but I don't know. I don't feel like testing them on that one. I don't want them to be right with that one thing. So I follow the order to not fly. And that is definitely an ability that I long miss. Also, since I am tethered to an enormous 80-pound oxygen concentrator 24/7, my mobility is also severely curtailed. I do have a tank on wheels that I can take with me to get around places, but it doesn't last that long. I don't think it would be enough to do much of anything. At most, maybe an hour. I mean, sure. I can take my dog for a slow walk. And I do. And I have been able to do that. But good luck going to a nice meal, you know. And before this occurrence, I gotta tell you, I was a raging foodie. Going to new restaurants, trying new things, eating very well for me was one of my most favorite things in the universe. Again, you can't separate the physical from the emotional. Anyway, I'm trying. But the ability to go out overall is gone for the most part. For the most part. And doing things around the house that might be laborious in any way. Putting away books in a bookshelf. Scrub cleaning the shower or bathtub. Things like that for me are just dangerously exhausting. And I just physically can't do many of those things that require some physical output. So it is very difficult. Do you have any real quality of life right now? I'm essentially tethered to my apartment with some exception, but very, very little. And if I push it, if I do things around the house, if I push it at all physically, let's say I've got a day where I'm feeling really good, and this happens. I have a single day, let's say I'm feeling really good, so I get a lot of stuff done just around the house. But then the next day, I pay for it in spades. I am just, in some cases, totally immobilized. Just the other week, I mean, literally 2 weeks ago, I was bedridden. Did I say bedridden? No, bedridden for a few days because of that. I woke up and I was in so much pain that I could not leave the bed. I had to request a wheelchair, and my nurses had to come in with a key to my home to see me. And it was terrible. So even on those good days, it's not necessarily a full reprieve. I have to be careful to where I don't pay for it the next day. And oftentimes, I do. So that has been probably the two biggest changes for me in this struggle. Physically being basically tethered to my home, unable to leave except for several minutes, maybe up to an hour, and unable to do even things around the house without severe ramifications the following day. There are definitely other physical issues, but those are by far the two big ones. And it's something that's very hard for me, as you could well imagine, to even adapt to. And that's something I struggle with every single day. Every day. So, it's definitely become much worse over time. For example, being bedridden, as I was very recently, I couldn't move without severe pain. And I can't do things outside the home. I can't do burdensome things in the home. So, oh, there's all of that and a general long-standing feeling of just constant exhaustion. I just constantly feel fatigued, and there's constant pain, which is another big factor physically, because I suffer a lot from edema. That's something that happens to you when you have heart failure. Your blood gets pumped down into especially your lower extremities, so your feet and your calves, but your heart is getting so weak, it can't pump it back. And my feet can swell up so big that I have no hope of even putting on a shoe. And it is extraordinarily painful. And if I get somebody to help out, which is literally to push the fluid out of my feet and calves back towards the heart, 11 out of 10 on the pain scale for me. I start out screaming with the most awful pain I've ever felt, because you're pushing all this fluid through such small vessels in my feet and ankles. And it just hurts beyond word. But if someone does that for me, eventually the swelling, you'll see it physically. You can watch as you can tell the swelling goes down. I mean, it's visibly there. You can see it. And as it shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, the pain gets better and better and better. Until when they do it, there's no pain. That's when I go, okay, stop. We've moved all the fluid out. And then for maybe a couple hours, I am just feeling fantastic. I got no edema, no pain. But then, of course, the fluid slowly just goes right on back and forms edema again. And so I go through all that for just 2 hours of being able to be without pain and to be able to put on a shoe. It's no way to live. It is awful. So, those are the big physical changes that I, unfortunately, have had to deal with. And I wouldn't wish that kind of life upon anyone, because it is so brutal, especially for an active person. Again, this is happening to me in my 40s, not my 90s. If I were in my 90s, I might not notice so much. I might be in bed all day anyway. But that wasn't me. I did live a very active life, relatively speaking. Traveled extensively all over the world in the vast majority of states. And now I'm tethered to a machine. And I am in constant pain. So, as I already said, I wouldn't wish this upon anyone, even if they were my worst enemy. It is just awful from a physical standpoint. And, well, that's my two cents on how it is for me physically to be going through the dying process. Now, after that trail down doom and gloom lane, there's a lot of things, though, that I do want to say I'm still very grateful for. So, it's been surprising even to me that when going through this experience, I have maintained, for the most part, a positive, maybe not positive, maybe I don't know what to call it. Here's what I'll say. I've maintained a confident sense of self. And that's actually amazing. And a lot of that comes from the things that I'm still grateful for. And just to focus on the physical aspect again, I'm not going to try to touch too much on the emotional. But the word grateful itself is an emotional word, so it's kind of hard to. Again, it's sort of hard to divide those two things. But I'm going to try to here. Absolutely grateful for when I do take my dog out for a walk. Obviously, they're not very long, but those are still very enjoyable for me. It's like, for me, it's like no matter whatever else is going on, it wipes the board clean. I mean, I guess, yeah, it is all emotional, but it's based on a physical act, so. I mean, here's how I can put it. When I was working from home, I didn't do it all the time. I had an office and all that, but occasionally, yeah, I was working from home. And I could still have really bad days with work, dealing with really stressful stuff or people, whatever it might be. And when I would just stop what I was doing and take my little guy out for just a short walk to the nearby park, which is what I would always do, you know, so a short thing, Get outside. Get in the sun if it's sunny, you know. And I truly enjoy that. I really love doing that with my dog. With the both dogs I've had, as this calamity has been visited upon me. So I am very grateful that if I time it right, I'm equipped properly, and I plan properly, I can still make that happen. Because, again, when I would do that when I was working from home, it was like magic. It would erase all the stress. And just 10 minutes, that's all it takes. And it would just wipe away all my angst. And I'd come back home, sit back down on my work laptop, not on it. That wasn't fun, but no, at it. And it was like I was a new guy, you know. It was just so. It was just so relieving, and it just took my mind off things, and it just. It was something that just changed everything, and it is still like that for me, and that I am totally grateful for. Because when I take my dog out, I'm just not pissing and moaning and groaning behind him, going, "Ah, this sucks." Yeah. No, you know, I'm like, "What is that? What is this? New smells there? Ooh, is that your column now that you just peed on?" You know, I have fun with him. I'm talking to him, I'm interacting with him in the physical environment. You know, we're having fun, you know, and it's just. It is just truly an enjoyable experience. So, if you haven't tried that, if you work from home, and if you have a pet dog that you can take out for like a 10-minute walk, do it. And don't just walk behind them thinking about work. Engage with them, you know. Bring a toy, bring a ball, you know, it's something. And I swear, at least for me, when I got back to my office, home office, I was a new person. So that is still there, and I'm very grateful that I can still do that, and that is without question. So,
and there was much rejoicing.
yes. So that is probably the biggest thing, honestly, I am grateful for. And despite the prolonged downturn of my quality of life, I have absolutely had moments in my life, let's say in the last 3, 4 years, whatever it's been, that were undeniably fun for me. And I am grateful for those moments. I guess that's more of an emotional thing. But for those moments that I could still enjoy myself with the physical limitations I have. I would have missed them if I had died, or as they originally predicted in those first 2 weeks. I would have never experienced them. So even with the severely diminished quality of life, I am grateful for those moments where I learn something new, I do something fun. Nowadays, I am very grateful. Again, dog related. You can tell I'm a dog person. I love playing with my dog. We have a blast. I mean, I'm laughing and giggling through it. It's not fake for me, you know. I'm just not sitting there quietly in a chair throwing a toy across the room and ignoring him otherwise. No, it's full interaction. We bond, you know, so I'm grateful for the fact that I can still physically do that with my dog because it means so much to me. And much like a walk, it just resets everything. It just becomes just a moment that you would not want to miss for anything. And I am very grateful for the physical ability to still do that with my dog.
And there was much rejoicing.
So, I think that's the two big things, more or less, that I'm really grateful for. On the physical side, not much. Again, I'm sorry. It's just the way it is. There's a lot of bleed over to emotional here. Again, you can't really cleave the two apart entirely. But trying to focus on just the physical components, I still find moments of joy through physical acts that I'm able to do to this very day. I must not forget that. And I will try to maintain these sorts of abilities, maybe even just for a few moments. 5 seconds of it, I don't know. Because I could always be grateful for those moments. And even though it's a pain of a long drawn out, up and down, up and down, up and down, with the gradual overall decline, there are many times I would not have traded for anything. And that is the God honest truth. So, with all that said, I'm also grateful for separating this topic into two episodes, because my God, this was a much longer episode than I initially anticipated. And for that, I sincerely thank you from the bottom of my heart to give me the time to express these thoughts and visit them with you. Whoever and wherever you may be, I seriously do thank you. You've given me the best gift you possibly could. And hey, that's something else I am grateful for. You know, when you go looking for it, gratitude is not that hard to find. It really isn't. And I've got to keep that in mind for those moments when I feel like I don't have anything to be grateful for. We all have those moments. I know we do. I'd be terrified if someone never did. I would put them in a padded room. Anyway, we all have those moments when we feel like there's nothing to be grateful for. And for me, taking a step back and looking at things at 30,000 feet, so to speak, because I can no longer go to 30,000 feet, literally, has really helped me. Just now, to appreciate those few things. That I mentioned here today. So, if you wish to be sure to hear the second segment of this topic, be sure to follow this podcast and turn on all alerts. I don't know what application you're using to follow the podcast, but generally there should be a subscribe selection, and there's usually a bell that you can click on for notifications. If you don't see it, it might be buried under an ellipses or some other menu on the application that you're using. So I encourage you to do that to ensure you're around for the second topic. And all other future topics for that matter. And if you really want to support this podcast, you can do so on its main page on Patreon, or you could even go to main page on Spotify. Excuse me. And also, you can go to patreon.com/ my dog will eat my face. So there's two ways there to show your support. If you wish to do so, but again, you've already given me the most I could ask for, and that was a chance for me to share my experience with you. I'm very grateful for that. See how easy it is? Once you go looking, suddenly you're grateful for every little thing. Even if you're dying. But for now, since it was such a long podcast, I am now going to close it out and leave it at that. And say, auf Wiedersehen.